From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headlee. There's nothing like the world through a child's eyes.
They seem to love bubbles.
Oh, God. They go ape over bubbles. I mean, that's an incredible thing about a child. I mean, what's so great about bubbles?
They float. You can pop them. I mean, I get it.
I wish I liked anything as much as my kids like bubbles.
That's sad.
It's totally sad. Their smiling faces just point out your inability to enjoy anything.
Well, we hope you enjoy this show. We're going to talk about why kids in Georgia are not exactly set up for the happiest possible childhoods. And in stark contrast, we're going to get some expert recommendations for summer fun for families. That's all coming up this hour. First, let's go back to the CDC for a moment. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention welcomed our program to their Atlanta headquarters on Friday for a special show on public health. One of our guests was Georgia State University professor and former CDC researcher Terry Pachacek. He talked about Americans' self-destructive behavior when it comes to our health.
Adolescents will drive by the fast food not because of health, but because they are disgusted by the food system, by the abuse within the corporate food system. Just like the adolescents passed the pack of cigarettes because they were mad at the industry. We need to do that in alcohol. We need to do that in food. We need to do that in built environment. And we particularly need to do it in climate change. We need to build the emotional side of it. It is not an intellectual issue. It's an emotional issue. The average person makes decision more on emotion than on fact.
And here are some of your first thoughts. Sam Burnham tweets that what Terry Pachacek says is, quote, a broad problem. It's also how we wind up with these two major party candidates this year. Veronica McClendon also weighed in. She tweets, at the doctor, the first approach is often medicine, even with lifestyle diseases. You ask about nutrition, and the doctor has few suggestions. Then you think, hey, maybe I know more than the doctor. Well, you can hear our entire hour from the CDC at gpbnews.org. It includes an interview with CDC Director Tom Frieden and a look at how the public health agency has been portrayed in Hollywood. After a listen, tell us what you think. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk. You can also call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. Or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Our youngest Georgians face some of the toughest challenges in childhood. Georgia ranks 42nd in the nation in overall child well-being, says a recent report by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. The 2016 Kids Count data report ranks factors in education, health, community, and economic variables. And although Georgia has seen some improvements in some areas, the overall picture for our state's kids is far from ideal. Again, 42nd in the nation. Joining us now to discuss the data is Laura Speer. She's the Associate Director for Policy Reform and Advocacy for the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Also with us is Andy Miller. He's the editor of Georgia Health News. Welcome back to the show, Andy.
It's good to be here.
First of all, Laura, can you just get us in on the ground floor of how this report works? What do you look at?
Well, we've been doing the Kids Count data book at the Annie Casey Foundation for a long time. This is actually our 27th report. We've been doing it since 1990. We do it because we think it's important to lift up issues of child well-being on a national agenda. We use data that comes from the federal statistical agencies like the CDC, like the Census Bureau, that's comparable across the 50 states. And so we look at data for all 50 states. In this report, we look at 16 different measures of child well-being. They include everything really from infancy all the way through young adulthood and cover economic well-being, education, health, and different measures around the health of the family and the community in which kids live.
Andy, let's just look at health metrics in particular. Where are Georgia kids struggling right now?
Well, actually, we've improved in certain areas. We've got fewer low birth rate babies. We've got fewer kids without insurance, health insurance, for example. But we're still, the numbers are still higher than national averages. We still have 8% of our kids who don't have health insurance. And that leads to basically worse health outcomes for these kids. So while we've gotten better since 2008 on these statistics, we're still lagging the national average.
Laura, where do the non-health-related statistics for Georgia fall? Education, things like that?
Well, it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, certainly, one of the key drivers we know for well-being for kids is the economic well-being of families, that if a child lives in a family that's got a very low income, it often affects all kinds of things, their education, their health, sure, and many other things throughout adulthood. So when we look at, for example, the rate of child poverty in Georgia, it's 26% of children lived in households with incomes below the poverty line in 2014. It's about 650,000 kids in the state. It's the thing that's most disconcerting about this number to me is that it's actually higher than it was in 2008, which was really at the height of the recession. In Georgia, 20% of kids live below the poverty line in 2008. Now that rate is 26%. So what you can see pretty clearly is that families in Georgia have really not yet recovered from the recession.
Yeah, we spoke to Rebecca Rice. She is the Georgia Kids Count Coordinator at Georgia Family Connection Partnership. And she told us that the low score can absolutely be attributed to the recession. Let's hear what she said.
One thing I've noticed in Georgia is that right before the recession hit, we actually made it as high as 37th, and we were showing some really good progress and really good trend data. But when the recession hit, it hit Georgia a little bit later than the rest of the nation, and it also hit really, really hard, and we just haven't recovered economically.
Andy, looking at health data as you do, does that explanation line up with what you see?
Well, I think what the poverty statistic is very important because it leads to a lot of bad things for kids. I mean, you're talking about a lot of kids who are in poor performing schools. You're talking about a lot of kids without insurance or without access to health care, and a lot of kids who don't have the access to recreational opportunities. And, you know, many of them don't have transportation in the household, and so that leads to a lot of problems in terms of getting good food choices into these households. So I see all of that kind of leading to more health problems for kids in poverty, more untreated health problems.
But Laura, the recession was a national phenomenon. Are other states recovering when Georgia is not, based on this data?
Well, I think, you know, at the national level, this poverty rate is still higher than it was in 2008. So it really, as a country, when we look at especially low-income families, they really have not yet recovered from the recession. There's no doubt about that. That said, there's some places, and as Rebecca, as you just played the clip, some places began the recession earlier, ended it more quickly, have come, you know, it didn't hit as hard as in Georgia, so I think there's been places where the recovery has been a little bit more quick. I think but as a whole, as a country, we've not yet recovered from the recession, especially for low-income families.
We're talking about Georgia's low ranking when it comes to child wellness, 42nd in the nation, according to the Annie E. Casey Foundation. We're speaking to Laura Speer of that foundation, also Andy Miller of Georgia Health News. And I suppose something that we should be clear about is that this data that we're discussing, we're talking about the state in aggregate. No doubt the picture is very different in pockets of wealth and prosperity. Kids in Buckhead or North Macon are probably doing just fine, right, Andy?
I would say there is a big disparity between access to health care, for example, and kids who are in those affluent areas versus kids who are in rural areas which have a high poverty rates or even inner city areas. And so there is a great difference between their access to health care for kids who can get to a pediatrician who have transportation in their household versus kids where some kids in counties that don't have a pediatrician, for example.
Sure. Let's listen to one more clip from Rebecca Rice. She's with the Georgia Family Connection Partnership. Here she is highlighting one of Georgia's most glaring weaknesses when it comes to childhood well-being.
So we're 40 or better in every domain except for that economic well-being, where we're ranked 45th in the nation. We have a very high child poverty rate. We have a high rate of children whose parents lack secure employment, which might speak to our high rate of working poor. So people who do have jobs, but those jobs don't necessarily make ends meet, or they don't allow people to afford childcare and stuff like that. And those are down from their height at the recession, but they're still well above the national average. And I think that's what's really still dragging Georgia down in the rankings.
So, Andy, in terms of social services, is Georgia equipped to offer sufficient assistance to families who are struggling with things like childcare?
Well, I think in those families, that a lot of them here in Georgia are headed by a single parent, and that parent with kids often has to work two jobs to make ends meet. And so a lot of times, no, they don't have the access because they're just struggling to get food on the table and get rent paid and things like that. So I think that we as a state really could use some strong investment, not in these communities for good jobs and also to raise up the performance of the schools to give these kids a chance to really succeed.
Laura, looking at your foundation's research, what are the states that are performing really well in terms of childhood wellness, and what are they doing right that Georgia could emulate?
Well, we look at these measures. We do rank all the states against the measures, and what we found when we did the overall ranking this year, we found that Minnesota ranks number one for overall child well-being, and it's the second year in a row that the state of Minnesota has ranked as high as it has. I think, you know, certainly the state has done well throughout the 25 years that we've been doing Kids Count. They haven't been number one, but they have been in the top 10.
So what's different? What do they do different? Or is it just the demographics that are different?
Well, a lot of the story has to do with the economics of the state, that generally speaking, the unemployment rate is low in Minnesota. They actually spend quite a lot of money on the education system as well as the healthcare system for kids. And they have, they invest in kids for certain. Mm-hmm. Even in Minnesota, there are pockets, as there are everywhere, where, not every kid in Minnesota is doing great. There are places where they have some of the biggest gaps by race in their data in a place like Minnesota, which can be surprising to people who expect that, a place like Mississippi might have bigger gaps. But in fact, places like Minnesota and Wisconsin have some of the biggest gaps. So there, I think, certainly that the investment in kids makes a difference, that having an economy that can help ensure that parents can get jobs where they can support their families makes a difference, providing work supports like child care subsidies, like health insurance coverage, which is huge. And that's one of the things that I think at the national level has been, and even in Georgia, although the rate of children without health insurance is higher than the national average, it's lower than it was at the height of the recession.
And prior to the Affordable Care Act, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely because of public investment in health insurance coverage. The private sponsored health insurance has gone down.
Indeed. We're going to have to leave it there. Laura Speer is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. We've been talking about her data. Andy Miller is with Georgia Health News. Thank you both very much for talking about something very important.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for having me.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Just before the break, we were talking about how Georgia, at least according to the Annie E. Casey Foundation, ranks 42nd in the nation in terms of childhood well-being. Not a happy story, but of course we don't want to give you the wrong idea that, and in fact, it is the case that growing up in Georgia has its perks. We have wonderful cultural diversity. We have geographic diversity, offers countless different experiences and adventures for the younger generation. And even the nerdy reputation of cities like Atlanta and Marietta makes for great cons, cosplay, gaming opportunities, lots of fun things for families to do, especially in the summertime. I'm going to welcome a pair of family fun experts to the show right now. Leslie Peterson is owner of 365 Atlanta Family. Welcome, Leslie. You are also the official family and travel expert and spokesperson for the state of Georgia, which is a thing, apparently, huh?
Yes. Thank you, Adam.
That's cool. We're going to be joined. Oh, we do have Sue Rodman, I'm told. Fantastic. Sue Rodman publishes the travel blog Field Trips with Sue. She joins us now via Skype. Hello, Sue.
Hello.
Before we get into this, let's just, you know, get right to the meat of it. I would like both of you to name one place, perhaps even the place, that you think families should try to visit in the state this summer. Sue.
I love the Atlanta Botanical Gardens, and they have a new children's garden that they've opened up. When the old garden was one of my children's favorite places to go, they have a flower shower. They've got lots of different plants, but at first I thought it was going to be just plants for kids, but it's not. It's a whole outdoor kind of playground.
That's a really good tip. Listeners, we would love to know your tips as well. Any favorite places to do family visits in Georgia? Tweet us your recommendations right now at OST Talk, or you can hit us on Facebook as well. Leslie, if there's one place that families should visit in the state this summer, what is it?
I would say go north to the mountains. You can snorkel, so just buy a snorkel at Walmart, head to the Conasauga River Basin. It's the most biodiverse river basin in the world, and you can snorkel there with your kids for free.
Freshwater snorkeling, something that has never occurred to me.
It's a lot of fun. It's cold water, but a lot of fun, so you want to go in summer.
Gotcha. Okay. In terms of sort of general attractions, I mean, what makes Georgia an attractive place to do things with your family, Leslie? Is there some common thread behind the opportunities within the opportunities that are available here?
What I love about Georgia for family adventure is we have mountains, we have the Everglades, we have the coast, we have all of that in one state. So no matter where you go, you can experience something different and unique with the kids. We love going hiking in the mountains. We spend a lot of time playing in the waterfalls, going to Springer Mountain and hiking, which is the beginning of the Appalachian Trail. We love going to the coast. St. Simon's is fun. We just went to Little St. Simon's this year, and we had naturalists adventuring with us and showing us different species of fish and things that we'd never seen before. We saw a huge rattlesnake as we were heading to the beach. You could go to the Everglades and go boating out there, or go tromping along the canopies there. It's just, there's so much. Georgia's so full of diversity, geodiversity, that you're never going to be bored. You don't have to leave the state.
Sue, as Leslie was going through that lovely litany, my dad brain was calculating dollar signs. Cost can be a prohibiting factor for a lot of families. What are some ideas for families who are on a budget?
Well, there are a lot of things that are free that you can do. So Leslie mentioned Little St. Simon's Island, and we spend a lot of time on St. Simon's Island, which is a little bit different. Little St. Simon's is a private island. St. Simon's is a public island. And one of the things that I love to do there are finding the tree spirits. So on St. Simon's Island, carved in trees are spirits. And there is one that is a full mermaid. So it's fun to kind of go and explore the island and just look for those tree spirits. It's also a great island to bike. So you can bring your bikes down there and go along the bike paths and maybe try to find the tree spirits as well. So there's a lot wherever you go. Atlanta has a lot of free things as well. And some of the attractions or museums that are in Atlanta that do have paid admission will also have free days. That takes a little bit of planning. You can't decide on a Saturday that you want to go and you want to go for free. Right. But the High Museum of Art has free days for Fulton County residents. There's Target free days at the Children's Museum. The Booth Western Museum, which is in Cartersville, Georgia, is a wonderful place for kids. They have, in their basement, they have the Sagebrush Ranch, which is basically an indoor playground. They also have, the kids go through the museum, you can get for free a saddle bag. You borrow it from the front desk, and you have lots of items in the saddle bag that help you go through the museum. You pull out a buffalo hide so that you can actually feel the buffalo hide as you're looking at a painting of buffalo. And
that's
the Booth
great.
Western Museum is free for children 12 and under all the time. And then on the first Thursday of the month from 4 to 8 p.m., it's free for everyone. So that's just one example of a free day. So if there's a place you want to visit or you're interested in, inquire with them. You know, is there a way? The throughout
do,
Georgia,
do the free days tend to be on weekdays rather than weekends?
Sometimes. The Fulton County free days at the High Museum are actually on weekends. And you can also do the Museums on Us through Bank of America, which is a weekend as well. So it kind of depends.
Leslie, and I should say to the listeners, we're talking about some family fun ideas, things that can be done around Georgia, particularly in the summertime with kids. Leslie, sometimes the weather doesn't cooperate. Sometimes it's rainy. And even when the sun is out, it can be so oppressively hot that nobody wants to be outside. Any favorite indoor ideas?
I love Ink. That's in Gainesville. It's a town that they've taken to on a small scale. So it's very comfortable for children to go in and see, for example, a courtroom or a barbershop or a bank. They can milk a cow. They can get inside an airplane. It's a really fun place to escape up in Gainesville. You can also try any number of the museums. High Museum has backpacks available for children. They can take in the Green Learning Library, where they've got a hands-on opportunity to experience the art that's there. Right now, there's an Eric Carle exhibit. You've probably read the book, The Hungry, Very Hungry Caterpillar. If you haven't read it, you've at least heard of it.
Sure.
Eric Carle is the author of that. So a number of his artwork on display there with the scavenger hunt specifically for kids to take in. So the museums are where we tend to go when the weather's not cooperating.
I think that there are a lot of historical sites in the state, and that tends to, as a grown-up, that tends to really turn my crank. But I worry about whether or not any of them would be of interest to kids. Are there historical sites that are likely to have cross-parent-kid interest? Either of you want to take that?
Absolutely. We just went. Both of us love the historic sites. So we just went to Fort King George in Darien, Georgia, and that place is awesome. We went for July 4th, and they had costumed interpreters, which is always fun. So you can look on the Georgia State Park sites or the National Park sites and see when they're going to have special events. But even if you don't go for a special event, my children had a blast because they have a reconstructed blockhouse and a reconstructed bunkhouse, so that fort is actually there. It's not ruins. And when you go into the visitor center, they have wooden guns that they let you take into the fort.
Oh, so they can climb up and defend the fort.
Absolutely. So even my teenagers were in there. We went over Christmas, so it was not as buggy and hot, and two, there weren't as many people there. So they had a blast running around the fort. And I look up as some older people are coming through and I'm like, okay, boys, we need to, you know, dial it back a little bit here. And I look up and this man is hanging out the window with his finger shooting at the boys. So it's fun for all ages.
Leslie, did you want to add to that with our last minute?
I would say stop by New Echota. It's the beginning of the Trail of Tears. It was the original capital of the Cherokee Nation. My boys love it there. The Atlanta History Center is wonderful. When we go there, we spend most of our time outside exploring that farm. And don't forget the Georgia State Parks. You can get an annual pass to the Georgia State Parks very affordably, and then that makes that a free visit in places around the state all year long.
Fantastic.
Or you can get a one-time visit, check it out at your local library. All of the Georgia public libraries have a state park pass.
Yes.
Well done, guys. All right. Leslie Peterson is the owner of 365 Atlanta Family and the official family travel expert and spokesperson for the state of Georgia. Sue Rodman publishes a travel blog, Field Trips with Sue. Check them both out online. Great ideas, guys. I can't wait to get out there with my family. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Big Brothers Big Sisters of Metro Atlanta needs volunteers. The wait list has more than 600 kids who want and need mentors. Bianca Hughes has been a big sister to Alexis Smith for more than 5 years. They met when Alexis was 12. Alexis and Bianca paid a recent visit to our studio to look back on how their relationship has grown since that first meeting.
I'm so nervous.
What are you worried about?
I don't know. I feel like I'm going to mess up.
And what are you going to mess up and do? I don't know.
So what are you worried about?
I don't know. I just, like, in my head is like, something's gonna happen.
Okay, then we'll address it when we come to it. Go with the flow, enjoy it.
The flow.
Just enjoy the moment.
Yep.
So, Alexis, what was it like the first time that you met? Do you remember what it was like, what we did, or how you felt, or if you don't remember anything, it's okay.
Well, I remember, like, us in this room with a whole bunch of other people.
I forgot about the people.
Yeah, there was, like, a whole bunch of other people, and I was just sitting and waiting. I was, like, very nervous, and I had my head down, and...
Yeah, you had your head down. Your grandma had to say, look up, look up, look up.
Yep, she just kept saying, look up. I'm like, no, I don't want to. So you came in, and I was shy. Like, I didn't want to say anything. Like, I was like a shy little girl, just like, I barely said hi to you.
Yeah, I remember. And I was like, is she going to speak? Okay, then. But I figured that the way I saw it was we just try it and we see how it goes and then we go from there. What are some of the hardest times for you? Or just in life in general, it's like been some of the hardest things. Maybe when you felt the most alone.
Like transitioning to living with my parents to my grandma's house. And it was just like that hard part because that was the year I lost my brother. And it was just like very, very difficult, and I didn't know how to recuperate and like be in another place with a whole bunch of other people, and I don't know how they're going to treat me. Are they going to leave me or this, that, and the other?
You mean if the people that you moved to were going to leave you?
Yeah. Like, I didn't know if I was going to stay here for a while or if I'm going to move to another place or I'm just going to move to another school, because my whole entire life I've been moving to school, to school, to school, to school, and to place, to place, to place, to place.
I'm very resilient.
Yeah. Question for you. What made you change your career and become a counselor?
I wanted a job where I made a difference in people's lives. I wanted a job where it was making an impact, and I wanted to use the gifts that God had given me. And that's actually how one of the reasons why I started volunteering with Big Brother, Big Sister and met you, because I knew that was something that I enjoyed doing. And so in working with you and just sharing my life, my wisdom, and wanting to share that, I realized the difference it made in people's life. And so I realized those were the gifts I had, and I prayed about it, and I realized it was to be a counselor. And here I am, and I will say you were impactful in that. You helped me make that decision.
Ta-da!
Thank you. So, in regards to when you first started the program, Big Brother, Big Sister, what was some of your expectations and what was the actual reality? What actually happened? Like, did it meet your expectations? Did it surpass it? Didn't even come into play? What were some of the expectations?
Well, in the beginning, my grandma asked me, do you want a sister? And I was like, yeah, I always want a sister. So she's like, okay, we'll put you in this program, see if you like it, and we'll adjust to it. So in the beginning, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like it. I don't know if she's going to like me or what type of stuff we're going to do or if it's going to be fun or boring. And turns out it wasn't as boring as I thought it would be.
Oh, you thought it would be boring?
Some of the stuff it was, but the majority of the stuff is like hanging out with you. It's just like fun. It's just like just sitting in the car and eating ice cream. Remember we went to Brewster's and we had ice cream?
Yeah.
Just sitting in the car and eating ice cream, just talking. That is like fun.
Okay.
And like you helping me out through my schoolwork and my problems and friends' problems.
So you weren't disappointed?
No, I was actually happy that I got you. Oh. I actually love you so much.
I love you too.
Aww, I feel so loved.
More information about the Big Brothers Big Sisters program can be found at gpbnews.org.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, filling in today for Celeste Headlee. Now, few of us journalists ever want to find themselves in the headlines, but that's exactly what happened a few weeks ago when a North Georgia newspaper publisher was jailed after he filed an open records request. He has since been released, all charges dropped, but the case is still attracting national attention and raises some very serious First Amendment issues. GPB's Sean Powers has the story.
I first met Fanon Focus publisher Mark Thomason a year ago on an assignment to learn more about corruption in Fanon County's recreation department. At the time, I joked with him that the stories he was reporting could make for a great HBO special. There was controversy in all corners and lots of drama. But very few people outside of North Georgia knew about his tiny paper. That's now changed.
Well, now at 5:30, a Georgia man was arrested after exercising his First Amendment right, not just as a newspaper publisher, but as a citizen.
The publisher of the Fanon Focus and the paper's attorney, Russell Stuckey, were both arrested last week and charged with identity fraud and making false statements.
First Amendment advocates I spoke with today tell me these charges against a Fanon County newspaper editor should never have been brought in the first place.
So here's what happened. A few weeks ago, Thomason was on the road on his way to meet a sheriff's deputy.
The interstate was at a standstill. Sheriff's deputies lined both sides of the interstate. The sheriff was parked in the middle of the interstate and was told to pull up to the sheriff's vehicle.
The sheriff told Thomason that there was a warrant for his arrest on three felonies, but at the time, he wasn't given details on each charge. He was sent to the Fanon County Jail for a few hours and then transferred to a jail in another county, about 40 minutes away.
A Pickens County deputy was there to transport me in. As I was getting in his back seat, my attorney, Russell Stuckey, was already in the Pickens County car. It was nice to see a face I recognized, but at the same time ask him if he was aware what in the heck is going on.
The charges stem from an open records request for canceled checks for the operating expenses of two area judges, Brenda Weaver of Appalachian Judicial Circuit and now former Superior Court Judge Roger Bradley. A Fanon County court reporter sued Thomason last year for libel after the Fanon Focus reported that a transcript didn't include racial slurs that were allegedly used by Bradley in court. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that both judges decided to use taxpayer money to cover the court reporter's legal expenses. According to the indictment, the identity fraud charges were based on subpoenas Thomason and his attorney sent to a bank that included Judge Weaver's checking account number. There was also a false statement charge tied to Thomason after he said in his open records request that the checks appeared to have been cashed illegally. Judge Weaver didn't return my calls and emails for comment. Dan Wisenhunt is with the Georgia chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. He says he was shocked these charges could happen anywhere in the United States.
Especially in Georgia, where we have one of the most up-to-date, unambiguous open records and open meetings laws, which, by the way, contain no clause that say if you file a records request for this or write it in this way, you could be jailed.
Speaking with the AJC, Judge Weaver defended the identity fraud charges, saying she worried Thomason would misuse her personal banking information on the checks. She's also quoted as saying that Thomason attacked her character in his newspaper and that she doesn't, quote, react well when my honesty is questioned. Donna Whitener is the mayor of Blue Ridge, which is the county seat for Fanon County. She says she doesn't think Thomason's rights were violated.
I would be real concerned if somebody was wanting copies of our checks at the city of Blue Ridge. The way he went about it wasn't correct.
Okay. But simply requesting those is one thing, but do you think that warranted charges?
I would think so. I don't think he was just trying to do it through the open records request. I think he kind of went around the system to get it.
But Dan Wisenhunt says there were better ways Judge Weaver could have handled this, other than filing the felony charges against Thomason and his attorney.
Government agencies have the right to redact information like bank account numbers. That's very clear in the Open Records Act. That's a very specific exemption. But you don't throw someone in jail for making a records request just because you thought that they've offended your honor. I'm not really sure what country she thinks she lives in, but this is the United States. We don't throw journalists in jail for asking questions.
Wisenhunt says the Society of Professional Journalists has filed a complaint against Judge Weaver with the 7-member Judicial Qualifications Commission, which could decide to have a trial over the complaints before deciding if a punishment is needed. Lester Tate chaired the commission before resigning this year.
The commission, if it takes any public action, it has to afford the judge due process rights, a public reprimand, a suspension with or without pay, removal from office, and removal from office with a lifetime ban on judicial service are all options that are out there in any case.
Now, the interesting wrinkle is that the commission is chaired by Judge Weaver.
I don't recall a member of the commission ever being the subject of a trial.
Tate says the big question facing the commission is whether Judge Weaver used her office to settle a personal grievance.
If it's decided that there is potential to move forward with it, then what you would probably have here is all of the other currently serving commissioners recusing themselves and being replaced by former members that didn't serve with the judge against whom the complaint's been filed.
The day after I spoke with Lester Tate, District Attorney Allison Sosby filed a motion to drop the charges. She declined to comment since that motion still has to be approved by a court. Tate says dropping the criminal charges has no real effect on the judicial complaint filed by the Society of Professional Journalists. In the motion to dismiss, Judge Weaver says she never intended to diminish or infringe on First Amendment rights and that the public shouldn't be discouraged to report wrongdoings by public officials. Carolyn Carlson is the director of the journalism program at Kennesaw State University. She says the state's open records laws don't need to change because of this case, but she thinks what happened has set a precedent.
That's just flies in the face of government transparency and the whole principle behind open records. And I don't think that you'll see these kinds of charges again. I think they're infamous at this point.
Back at the Fan and Focus, Mark Thomason continues to wait for the charges against him to be officially dropped. Until that happens, conditions of his bail are set in stone, which include random drug tests, searches of his home and office without a warrant, and he can't be within 200 yards of certain people, many of whom are county employees.
We're a small community, so most meetings take place at the courthouse, election board meetings, water authority meetings, county commission meetings, tax assessor meetings, and those are things that I can't cover at the moment. You know, actually early voting is taking place at the courthouse. I can't go vote.
Thomason says he's going to move forward with a lawsuit over his First Amendment rights being violated, but he says he's not sure who will be included in that suit. Two attorneys in Atlanta are representing him pro bono. For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
Nice work, Sean. Now, here's the thing, folks. This right to request documents from government officials, this is not a right that is exclusive to us in the media. Everyone has this. You have this right. And trust us, it's pretty rare to get arrested for it. So for the rest of the show here, we're going to talk about ways that you can understand open records law and how you can use it, how you can use it to your advantage, how you can do whatever you want to do with it. Joining us now for that is Holly Manheimer. She is the executive director of the Georgia First Amendment Foundation. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So first of all, when we talk about open records laws, we tend to use this acronym FOIA, which stands for Freedom of Information Act. That's a bit of a misnomer, right? That just refers to the federal Freedom of Information Act, right?
Yeah, that's a really important distinction. FOIA or Federal Freedom of Information Act only applies to the federal government records. Every state in this country has its own equivalent. In Georgia, it's called the Open Records Act. It could be the Texas Public Meeting or Public Records Act. The state laws track the federal laws, but FOIA typically refers to federal public agencies.
Right. So you would use FOIA if you wanted to get some documents from the federal government. If you wanted to get some documents or information from state or local government, you would use the Georgia Open Records Act. And as you say, the local and state laws tend to track the federal law, but some of the state laws are even kind of better than the federal law, right?
That's a really great point. For example, in Georgia, the response time for a public agency to respond to a public records request is shorter than the federal government. In Georgia, typically we have less time delays than the federal government does in terms of responding to open records requests. So yes, sometimes the state laws are better. Sometimes worse, but sometimes better.
So how does one put in an open records request?
Well, in Georgia, it's a great thing. In Georgia, we are still lucky enough to have verbal open records requests. You can walk up to a public agency and say, hey, may I have this piece of information? The better, though, method is to file what's called an open records request, which in Georgia can take any form. I recommend that one does so in writing, because then you want to have a memorialization or a record. But you send that to the public agency by any means, email, letter, hand delivery, and wait in Georgia 3 business days for a response.
Yeah, they are required to reply within 3 business days. That doesn't necessarily mean they're required to give you what you want within 3 business days, though, right?
That's right. And I always teach it when I teach it, 3 options in 3 days. 1, the response everybody wants, here are the records, thank you for your request. 2, the second best response, hey, we've got the records, but they're in archives, they're old, it's going to take a while. Here's an estimated timetable of when you can get the records. And then 3, hey, unfortunately, these are not subject to release under the Open Records Act because of this reason. So 3 options in the 3 business days.
And if they tell you, listen, it's going to take us more than 3 days to get this together for you, is there then any kind of timetable that you can hold them to say, listen, you've taken an unreasonable amount of time dragging your feet on this request? Does the law hold their feet to the fire in any way after those 3 days?
It's a little difficult. The public agency is supposed to provide an estimated timetable. So estimated, first of all, needs to be reasonable, 10 days, 2 weeks, not 10 years. To the extent, though, that 10 days becomes in reality 6 months, that's going to then trigger the remedies section of the Open Records Act. So estimated timetable, there's some wiggle room there, but not if the agency then extends that to multi-months.
In terms of putting in the request, indeed, the Georgia Open Records Act doesn't specify any kind of particular medium in which you put in your request. You could do it verbally. You could, you know, put it on a cocktail napkin for all it matters. But Holly, let me tell you the strategy that I teach my journalism students at Mercer. You can tell me if you like it.
Okay.
I tell them to get a template. There are a lot of organizations like yours or the Sunlight Foundation that have open records request templates for each state that you can use that have a lot of really good boilerplate language in them. And that also includes, like, under this statute, and it's got the statute number with, like, the little squiggly line that's in statute names, and it just looks like you know what you're doing. It makes you look formidable when you put in that language into your request.
Yeah, and a lot of the journalism organizations have great templates. We've got one on our website that I wrote a number of years ago. But yeah, I mean, it cites in Georgia, it's 50-18-70. That's the Open Records Act. But yeah, it does give a certain amount of gravitas to the request. So yes, I like what you're teaching your students.
We're talking to Holly Mann. She is the executive director of the Georgia First Amendment Foundation. We're talking about Georgia open records law and open records law more broadly. It's not just for reporters. Anybody can use this to demand information and documents from your government. There's been a lot of talk about Hillary Clinton's private email server from when she was Secretary of State. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think that maybe one of the reasons that she did that was to avoid having her emails FOIA'd. In Georgia, are messages on a private email server or any email server open record subject to open records requests, emails between public officials?
Yeah, it's come up actually over the years with different county commissions and city councils. To the extent you are doing the public business from your home living room computer, those emails are still subject to release under the Open Records Act. We kind of say, regardless of the geography of your computer, to the extent you're doing open public business, that's subject to release under the act.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that if the email is on a public email server, there's many public officials who are going to have access to that server and therefore can help you in making sure that your open records request is fulfilled. But if an official is just doing business on her Gmail, for example, how is anyone going to verify whether or not she has actually given you what she's obligated to give you when you ask for it?
I mean, it's a tough question and a trickier answer, but whatever custodian who is responsible for a public agency's records has got to be aware that public officials or council members, commission members are using their private email accounts to do it. Again, we've litigated this issue in Georgia, but it's certainly true, regardless of whose computer or what email address, if it's about the budget of the city, that's going to be subject to release, right, even if it's on a Gmail account.
Well, in our just last 30 seconds or so here, Holly, a lot of states have mandatory training for public officials so they can learn about their obligations under open records law. Georgia does not. You think there should be?
I absolutely do, and it's something that over the different incarnations of the Open Records and Meetings Act in Georgia that have come in the last two decades, we and other groups have pushed for. I'd love to see it happen. I think it could only be an enhancement to our state.
Holly Manheimer is the executive director of the Georgia First Amendment Foundation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is it for our show today. Conversation, of course, continues 24/7. A lot of things you could weigh in on from this week's show. I'd love to know if you've ever tried to file an open records request. What was it for? Did it work? Did you get what you wanted? Tell us about that. You could also get in touch with us and talk to us about ideas for family-oriented summer fun that can be had around the state. Call us at 404-500-9457 to leave a message. 404-500-9457. You can also post to our Facebook page or tweet us at OST Talk, and we may use your comments on the show. For today, that's On Second Thought from DPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. I will be with you again tomorrow. See you then.